This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Ghosts, telepathy, alien abductions. Paranormal continues to fascinate us. But what does science have to say about these phenomena? Can they always be readily explained? And what makes people believe in the paranormal? Professor Chris French is the head of the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit in the Psychology Department at Goldsmiths, University of London. His latest book is entitled The Science of Weird Stuff. Well, that's not quite the title, but replace stuff with another word beginning with S and you'll have it. We got the chance to speak to Chris about his research into strange phenomena and what makes people believe in UFOs.
Hello, I'm Chris French. I'm Emeritus Professor of Psychology. I retired from Goldsmiths, University of London, Psychology Department in October 2020, and I've been incredibly busy ever since.
Yes, and the reason we're speaking today is about your new book, which should be out around about the time this podcast comes out, and it's all about sort of the science of the paranormal, I suppose, and a scientific explanation of the paranormal. As a psychologist and someone who deals in science, how did you come to sort of devote quite a lot of time to exploring the so-called paranormal?
I suppose I'd have to go right back to kind of childhood. I mean, I was into early adulthood. I actually believed in a lot of paranormal stuff. I mean, I was always fascinated by it as a kid. And even as a teenager, even when I went to university, did my first psychology degree. It was only when I was doing my PhD, which was not on any of the weird stuff at all. It was all about differences between the cerebral hemispheres and using EEG. It was all very scientific. And somebody recommended a particular book that they thought I'd like. It was called Parapsychology, Science or Magic. And it was by a guy called James Alcock, a Canadian social psychologist. And it was the first skeptical treatment of any of this stuff that I'd ever come across. And it kind of opened my eyes to this whole new way of thinking about things. And it kind of grew very slowly from there. You know, I mean, I started at Goldsmiths in 1985. And by that point, I kind of counted myself as being a card-carrying skeptic. I did a couple of lectures on one of the courses on parapsychology from a very skeptical perspective. And the students seemed to enjoy it, whether they were believers or skeptics. It's one of those topics that people get engaged with. And then about 10 years later, realized I could put on a whole course on this stuff. So I had a course originally called, I think it was Psychology, Parapsychology and Pseudoscience. And was occasionally just doing little studies here and there, but still carrying on with the more respectable research. I mean, it was made very clear to me that my interest in the weird stuff was tolerated but not encouraged. It just got to a point where I thought, well, that's the stuff that really interests me. There are very good arguments for taking it seriously because most people statistically believe in at least one paranormal concept. And a lot of people claim they've had direct experience of the paranormal. So there's something from a psychological point of view that needs to be explained there. And it can tell us a lot about how the mind works. So yeah, in the end, I ditched all the other stuff and devoted myself entirely to the weird stuff.
Do you come from a perspective of belief in the paranormal and things like that is a problem to be addressed? Does it worry you that the people believe in non-scientific things like that?
Again, when I first discovered the joys of skepticism, I think I kind of became what I would now see as being a kind of fairly extreme skeptic. And had a lot of views which were kind of that all kinds of paranormal belief are a bad thing to have, that all people who claim to have psychic powers are either crazy or deliberate frauds, that all parapsychology experiments were flawed, that parapsychologists didn't know how to do science. I don't believe any of those things anymore. The deeper I've got into it, the more I've modified and come back towards the central ground. And I suppose, with respect to the question that you've asked, paranormal beliefs can be dangerous insofar as it kind of depends on people's reasons for believing this stuff. But If it's because they just lack critical thinking skills, then that opens the door to a lot of other kind of beliefs that can be potentially dangerous. I mean, for one thing, I, surprise, surprise, I'm a skeptic when it comes to complementary and alternative medicine. And I think those people who practice that, even if they're totally 100% sincere, they can sometimes do a lot of damage because people can sometimes fail to get treated for stuff that their psychic healer says, you know, abandon conventional medicine, rely on my magical powers. That's dangerous. And there are all kinds of other examples you can think of. People are more likely to be ripped off by con artists pretending to be psychics. But again, I don't think that most people who claim psychic powers are deliberate con artists, but some of them are. So there's all kinds of potential dangers there. On the other hand, there are psychological benefits from believing in the paranormal. People do take psychological comfort from those kind of beliefs, particularly at times of stress and crisis and so on. So I think we need to separate the questions of whether or not these paranormal claims are ever true. You know, are there things that defy explanation in terms of conventional scientific concepts, from the questions about whether paranormal beliefs and paranormal practices are actually dangerous. Sometimes they can be, most of the time they probably aren't.
Do you find that there's a specific type of person, be that personality traits or even demographic, that believes in the unexplainable?
Yes, again, surprise, surprise, there's another yes and no answer. It's one of those, there are lots and lots of different factors that come into play. Personality is one of them, and there are certain kind of personality dimensions that pretty reliably correlate with paranormal belief. Things like fantasy proneness, a personality dimension called absorption, the kind of tendency that you might have if you're watching a film or reading a book to get totally engrossed in it. A lot of those, hypnotic susceptibility, a lot of those things that are involved in kind of being very creative often, you know, having a good imagination. Those kind of people are more likely to believe in the paranormal and they're more likely to report paranormal experiences. But it's not a perfect correlation, far from it, you know. So you might lack all of those quite desirable qualities and still believe in the paranormal, or you might have all of them and not believe in the paranormal. But if you compare in kind of groups with groups, believers with skeptics, yes, you would find personality variables that correlate with it. But there are all kinds of other factors as well. I mean, personal experience is an obvious one. There are lots of reasons why people might have genuinely weird experiences that maybe initially they can't explain. I mean, one of the things that we're really interested in is the phenomenon of sleep paralysis. And if you have an episode of sleep paralysis, which can involve hallucinations and all kinds of stuff, if you can't think of any other explanation, well, maybe ghosts or aliens seems to be the most logical explanation for it, you know? So it might be weird experiences like that. It might be that you've been brought up in a family where everybody's a strong believer. And most of us tend to adopt the kind of beliefs of our parents to some extent, you know? So there's all those kind of factors that come into play.
Do you think there's a set approach to addressing this, beliefs in the paranormal? And I suppose that question probably quite nicely leads into the anomalistic psychology research, which you headed, I believe, founded.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is sort of the psychologist's role, and how do you go about addressing this?
Well, there were kind of two main strands to the research that we did. I mean, most of the research we did was really focused on seeing if we could come up with non-paranormal explanations for ostensibly paranormal experiences, and also kind of looking at the kind of factors we've just been talking about that correlate with paranormal belief and so on. And wherever possible, seeing if we could actually put those kinds of skeptical explanations to the experimental test. You know, were the kinds of things that we were raising as possible alternative explanations, be it hallucinatory experiences or false memories or reasoning errors or all those, could we actually produce empirical evidence to support those kinds of explanations? So most of what we did was in that strand. But for me, a very important part of skepticism is to always be open to the possibility that you might be wrong. New evidence might come along that makes you change your mind. So there was a lesser strand of research where we would directly test paranormal claims. And in those cases, for those kinds of studies, the way that you test it depends very much on what the claim is. You design the test around the claim and you make sure that the claimant is happy with the way you intend to test it. You know, we would go to the lengths of getting them to sign something in advance to say, this is a fair test of my claim. And then when we tested them and they failed the test, they'd decide that it wasn't actually a fair test after all. That just happened again and again and again. But I mean, I think it was also kind of important to show that there is a degree of open-mindedness there. You know, I'm putting my skepticism kind of on the line here and putting it to the test, and we'll just see what the data comes out as.
if we're going to move on to UFOs and the belief in UFOs and flying saucers and things like that, where do you think that that ranks amongst other paranormal things that you investigate? Do you think UFOs are as commonly believed as something like ghosts or maybe telepathy?
Yeah, very much so, actually. Probably similar kinds of percentages. I mean, obviously it varies from survey to survey, but you will typically find about a third of people say they believe, you know, that aliens have visited the Earth. And, you know, probably about half that sometimes. Again, it varies, but, you know, certainly 10%-ish, 15% say that they have seen a UFO. Now, that, of course, raises the question of what do you mean by UFO? Do you literally mean an unidentified object in the sky? Well, fine, I don't have a problem with that. You know, we can all look up into the sky and not know what we're looking at. But, of course, it's kind of quite interesting that we automatically these days equate UFO with ET. And that's a huge inferential leap. It's kind of quite interesting that when you look back historically, you know, 1947 was a golden year. That was the year that the phrase flying saucer entered the English language. It was the year of Roswell. And there was also a kind of series of what they call UFO flaps at the time, where lots of people were reporting seeing things up in the sky, you know. But the surveys that were carried out at the time, when they were asking the general public what they thought this phenomenon was, often didn't even include ET as an option. It wasn't part of consciousness then, you know. It was things like Soviet military technology, a meteorological phenomenon, a celestial phenomenon, whatever else it may be. And yet now it would be the automatic go-to explanation for many people. If they see a light up in the sky, they don't know what it is. It's an ET, it's an alien. Well, of course, that's a huge inferential leap. And ufologists themselves acknowledge that well over 95% of sightings have a mundane explanation. If you put the time in, you can figure out, well, it was in that part of the sky, and it was at that time, we know that there was a meteorite, or there was a satellite re-entry, there was something, you know, it's on a flight path for aeroplanes, whatever. It's that kind of very small percentage that don't have an obvious explanation that gets them very excited. But why should we assume that we'll be able to come up with a definitive explanation for all possible sightings? I mean, the police can't solve all crimes that they investigate. So, yeah, it's the same thing. Sometimes the evidence just isn't good enough for us to be able to decide what it was.
Yeah, so it's almost like people believe in UFOs because we as a public have been told that they exist, even just through fiction. It's the idea that they exist. Fiction and, and popular culture. Do you think there's also a sort of an element of we would rather believe the exciting thing than assume it's a weather balloon?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, certainly that's why, you know, as a kid and as a teenager, why I was into the paranormal, it wasn't particularly of any great personal experiences I'd had. It's just that it's exciting. It's fun, you know, and I still feel that, you know, and again, people sometimes kind of say, well, how arrogant to assume that we're the only intelligent species in the universe. Well, we're not saying that. I mean, you know, if I had to bet, again, nobody knows, but on the basis of Drake's equation, yeah, I'd put my money on there being intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. It's a very big place, you know. I'm just not convinced that it's been visiting the Earth on a regular basis, you know. I mean, and things from a psychological point of view get really interesting when you go beyond just the kind of sightings, but onto the kind of alien abduction claims, because I've met, spoken to a lot of alien abductees, people who, in my opinion, sincerely believe that they have had contact with aliens. And there's only two possibilities, you know, either they really have or they haven't. And there's something really interesting going on from a psychological point of view. Now, my favorite explanation tends to be in terms of false memories. But, you know, I'm open to the possibility I might be wrong. It'd be really, really exciting if we do ever make kind of direct contact, but I'm not convinced that we have yet.
Yeah, and a lot of our listeners will probably know you from the Uncanny podcast. And I listen to that regularly. And one of the things I always notice is that people who believe that they've seen a ghost or believe that they've been abducted by an alien or they've seen a UFO, it's often they're on a country lane by themselves at night. It's never they're in a crowded city center during the daytime. So it sort of comes back to what you were saying about it's bias, would you call that?
It's hard to say. I mean, I'm sure if you were talking to somebody on the other side of the argument here now, they'd be saying, oh, but there are cases where, you know, it's been witnessed by other people and so on and so forth. And again, you have to look at each case on its individual merits. Even in those cases where it's claimed that there were multiple witnesses and so on, there's often reasons to be rather dubious about the claim that's being made. I mean, by and large, it does tend to be, I mean, a lot of these cases occur, you know, when people kind of report that they were in bed and suddenly They kind of felt paralyzed. They couldn't move. They felt a kind of strong presence. And then often they'd go through that experience. They don't actually directly see any aliens during this experience. But if they've had that kind of experience, which I would put down to sleep paralysis, which we know all about, and there's a medical and scientific literature on, but if they come across some article by a ufologist saying, if you've ever had this experience, you've been abducted by aliens and they have wiped your memory for the rest of the experience, then they might go to see a hypnotherapist for hypnotic regression under the mistaken belief that going through that will help them to recover hidden or repressed memories. It doesn't. It just provides a perfect context for the creation of false memories. So you end up with these apparent memories in your head, which feel very, very real. And if you already, obviously, you went to see this hypnotherapist because you suspected you might have been abducted by aliens, and you basically get what you expect with hypnotic regression. If you have it done thinking that you're going to uncover memories of being abducted by aliens, then there's a good chance that's what you'll get. If you think that you're going to uncover memories of being the victim of satanic ritual abuse, then that's what you're going to get. If you go thinking that you're going to uncover memories of past lives, that's what you're going to get. And, you know, it really is a very, very dodgy technique to use. But a lot of these cases, not all of them, but a lot of the cases do follow that kind of pattern.
We're sort of talking about individual cases at the moment, but how do you approach something like, and I'm particularly thinking about UFOs here, the cases where there have been, you know, multiple witnesses have all seen the same thing. And if you sort of think of 20 people all saying the same thing, that would be very, very powerful testimony in court. How do we then explain that, or how do we approach a situation like that?
I mean, lots of factors. Like I say, even with those multiple witness cases, you have to look at each one individually. But when you get cases like that, one of the phenomena that's relevant here is something called memory conformity. And that's a situation where if a group of people all witness kind of something unexpected and unusual, then before there's any kind of formal interview of them, they're likely to discuss it together. And sometimes you get situations where one person's account can influence another person's memory. And we've done kind of studies on this, not in the context of UFOs particularly, but in the context of spoon bending, where if you suggest to somebody that a spoon is bending right before their very eyes when nobody's even touching it, some people will kind of be affected by that suggestion. And, you know, we've done studies looking at this kind of memory conformity effect. The chances are that, you know, when you get those multiple witness cases in UFO context, there was something up in the sky. So, yes, they did all see something. Whether it was a metallic craft with little windows and aliens beaming, lit, smiling back at them, or whether it was actually Chinese lanterns or a weather balloon or whatever else it may be, who knows? But they're often kind of, you know, people can influence each other in those kind of contexts. So you have to, as I say, look at each case individually. But then I suppose after having done that, you then kind of have to stand back and say, well, okay, on balance, overall, do I think that any of these cases are likely to be kind of genuine ET contact? Or do I think that even for those cases where I don't have a ready explanation, because I wouldn't claim that I can explain away every single case you could put before me. I wouldn't do that. But you know, given that we know that people sometimes make mistakes, we know that people sometimes just make stuff up, then on balance, I'm going to need stronger evidence. Oh, and another point in this context is the fact that there are so many CCTV cameras, particularly in this country, and everybody carries a good quality camera around with them in the pocket these days. Why aren't there loads and loads of really high quality videos showing UFOs hovering over cities from different angles and so on and so forth? It just doesn't happen. It tends to be the same blurry, not quite sure what it is kind of thing that we're presented with. So, you know, there's the potential there to prove that, yes, these things really are flying around up there. So far, the evidence, I'd say, is far from convincing.
I think that was one of the things I also wanted to ask you was, as a psychologist, would you consider it part of your job to convince someone that they hadn't seen what they think they've seen, or is that not really part of your remit?
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, basically, when I've got my kind of scientist hat on, if you ask me for my view on a particular topic, I'll give you my honest opinion and my reasons for believing what I believe. I'm not necessarily out to convince you that you're wrong and I'm right. I mean, and that applies even more in other kind of paranormal contexts. I mean, anything that relates to, say, life after death. If you've got a situation where somebody is taking kind of great comfort from feeling that the spirit of a dearly departed loved one is still around and they're getting comfort from that, I wouldn't want to take that away from them. Why would I? You know, as far as I'm concerned, anybody can believe anything they like as long as it doesn't have negative impact on other people. But if you then ask for my honest opinion on what they're talking about, well, I'll give it to you, because that's what science is all about. Science is all about what's true, not necessarily what makes us feel good.
Mm. Yeah, we sort of touched upon it already, but is there an argument that the belief in spacecraft visiting Earth and people having seen that, is that a bit more credible than some of the other phenomena that you might investigate? Because you could at least argue it's very, very likely that there could well be some form of life beyond Earth.
I mean, to my way of thinking, yes, because I have kind of considerable respect for the laws of physics. And the idea that there's life out there and that it might conceivably kind of make physical contact with the Earth, yeah, it's possible. There'd be all kinds of problems to surmount, the vast distances. But, you know, you can imagine a scenario with suspended animation or, you know, advanced technology of some sort. Yeah, maybe it could happen. It doesn't actually require us to say the laws of physics, as we currently understand them, are completely, completely wrong, you know. I mean, again, they may be incomplete, but I don't think they're wrong, you know. But other kinds of concepts within the paranormal would require that kind of complete turning upside down of our current scientific view in major aspects. And therefore, as Carl Sagan was very fond of saying, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. The evidence has to be so much stronger for those kind of paranormal claims for us to take them seriously, because we've got a vast amount of evidence that generally supports the kind of conventional scientific worldview.
Just to close, where do you think your research will take you next? And it's such a wide-ranging topic. Do you see yourself doing a follow-up of the book, a sort of volume two?
I've been thinking about that, what might go into a follow-up, even though the book has come in at kind of more than 400 pages, which obviously I didn't realise when I started writing it was going to, but it has. There are still a lot of topics that I either barely touch on or even don't touch on at all. So, you know, there could be a possible follow-up on those lines. Another possibility that I've been thinking about is, as I mentioned, one of my areas of interest is that of false memories. And that's a nice example, I think, of a topic where looking at false memories as they relate to things like alien abduction claims and past life memory claims and so on, I think has implications for legal cases in the real world. And so, I mean, another possibility for a follow-up book would be to look at the kind of false memory from all those different kind of angles, as it relates to the kind of weird stuff, as it relates to real life legal cases, and just what it tells us about the way that memory works in general. You know, I mean, it's a kind of fascinating topic. So that's another idea I'm toying with, but I haven't decided yet. I'll see how well this book does first.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to Acast, iTunes, or Spotify.